Welcome to the 48th episode of Onk Live On Air. I'm your host today, Christy Rosa. Onk Live On Air is a podcast from Onk Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onk Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onk Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. We recently traveled to Tampa, Florida for State of the Science Summit on Gastrointestinal Malignancies. At the meeting, faculty from Moffitt Cancer Center and Mayo Clinic review the latest data in gastrointestinal oncology, covering all aspects of current care, from patient selection to the optimal timing of targeted therapy, immunotherapy, and chemotherapy in neuroendocrine tumors, hepatocellular carcinoma, pancreatic cancer, gastric and gastroesophageal cancer, and colorectal cancer. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Jonathan R. Strasberg, MD, and associate professor of medicine at Moffitt Cancer Center. Although novel therapeutic strategies have shown potential in recent clinical trials, somatostatin analogs are still the frontline standard of care for gastroenteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, said Strasberg. Listen on to hear from Strasberg on the latest developments made in the complex treatment paradigm of GEP NETs.
So I'll be focusing primarily on what's new in neuroendocrine oncology. I'm actually going to start with the discussion of somatostatin analogs in the CLARINET study. That's not exactly novel, but there's been a lot of interest in CLARINET, especially since lanreotide was approved for treatment of gastroenteropancreatic NETs about 2 years ago. Next, we're going to go on to the role of capecitabine temozolomide in pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors, particularly in light of the very exciting ECOG 2211 study, which showed a significant improvement both in PFS and in overall survival with CAPTEM versus TEM monotherapy. And really a fairly unprecedented PFS that was a primary endpoint of nearly 2 years with CAPTEM in patients with progressive pancreatic NETs. And finally talk about the NETTER-1 study and Lutathera and its role both in midgut neuroendocrine tumors and other gastroenteropancreatic NETs. Octreotide goes back to the early 1980s and was the first drug shown to palliate the carcinoid syndrome and subsequently palliate other hormonal syndromes associated with neuroendocrine tumors. Subsequently, the drug was also shown to inhibit tumor growth. There was a lot of indication that despite a low response rate, patients were having relatively long durations of time to progression, which led to the PROMID study, which was a smallish phase three study of octreotide LAR versus placebo in patients with midgut neuroendocrine tumors. And it was a positive study, actually strongly positive in terms of improvement in PFS, but it wasn't a registrational study and it didn't lead to a change in indication. So the indication of octreotide continued to be for control of carcinoid syndrome. Then Ipsen sponsored a much larger study of lanreotide in enteropancreatic neuroendocrine tumors with progression-free survival as a primary endpoint, the CLARINET study, which led to the first approval of a somatostatin analog for control of tumor growth. So we think both octreotide and lanreotide are very similar, both in terms of control of tumor growth as well as control of hormonal syndromes, but lanreotide does have formal approval for the tumor growth indication. So there's been quite a few small studies, small subsets of studies showing that capecitabine and temozolomide has really exceptional response rates in patients with progressive pancreatic neuroendocrine tumors. The ECOG 2211 study was the first randomized prospective study evaluating these drugs and really trying to establish whether the doublet capecitabine temozolomide is superior to temozolomide monotherapy. But I think also to provide a really information on temozolomide-based chemotherapy in a setting of a large prospective clinical trial. So it wasn't a phase three trial, it was a large randomized phase two study with about 145 participants. And what it showed was a very significant prolongation in PFS to nearly 2 years with the combination. And remember, these were patients with progressive disease at outset versus, I think, about 14 months with temozolomide monotherapy, and also a statistically significant prolongation in overall survival. So really, a fairly strong indication that CAPTEM is highly active. And the confirmed objective response rate was about 33%, so a little bit less than what we saw in the earlier single-arm studies, but a very rigorous definition of confirmed objective response. So proof that this is a active and also a tolerable combination.
Afterward, we asked Richard Kim, MD, about the therapeutic landscape of advanced hepatocellular carcinoma in light of recent findings and anticipated research in the field. Kim, an assistant professor of oncology at the University of South Florida College of Medicine and a medical oncologist in the Department of Gastrointestinal Oncology at Moffitt Cancer Center, explained, although pembrolizumab failed to result in a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival in patients with previously treated advanced hepatocellular carcinoma, the treatment armamentarium remains strong. This is due to the use of TKIs, monoclonal antibodies, and another checkpoint inhibitor.
Recently, there has been tremendous involvement of the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma. Since 2007, only really drug that was approved for treatment of advanced hepatocellular carcinoma was sorafenib. But recently, there has been a lot of advances in the treatment of HCC, including a couple more TKIs being approved along with immunotherapy being approved. So those are the areas that I'll be discussing today in my talk. Yes. In practice today, until last year, sorafenib was the only drug approved in first-line setting. Now there's another TKI called lenvatinib, which is another TKI, is a dirty TKI that blocks VEGF, PDGFR, FGFR pathway, that was now approved by the FDA last year based on the trial called the REFLEX study, which is a non-inferiority study comparing against sorafenib. It was a phase 3 study going head-to-head against sorafenib. And in the trial, they showed that lenvatinib was proven to be non-inferior compared to sorafenib. However, if you look at the secondary endpoints, such as time to progression, PFS, and response rate, it seems like lenvatinib had a superior time to progression, PFS, and response rate, yet the overall survival was very similar. Now, the difference between the toxicity profile is that sorafenib tends to have more of a hand-foot skin reaction. On the other hand, lenvatinib tends to deliver a little bit higher rate of hypertension. So there are subtle differences between those two drugs, but now we have another option for the patient to use in first-line setting. In second-line treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma in patients who fail sorafenib, now we have a couple of TKIs approved and immunotherapy approved as well. The first one that got approved in the second-line setting is a drug called regorafenib. It's a dirty, once again, a TKI, is a dirty TKI that blocks multiple pathway. That was used in a trial called the RESOURCE study. Now, in this study, the patient must have tolerated sorafenib at least 400 milligrams once a day to be eligible. In that study, you randomized against regorafenib versus placebo, and it shows that there was an overall survival with regorafenib. Therefore, based on the positive second-line study, the drug was approved in advanced hepatocellular carcinoma in patients who failed sorafenib. The second drug that was approved is a drug called cabozantinib. Cabozantinib is another dirty TKI that blocks VEGF, c-MET, and other pathways. Similar design of a study in patients who failed sorafenib or who were intolerant to sorafenib were randomized to cabozantinib versus placebo. In this study, you were allowed to up to one or two lines of therapy, and the primary endpoint is overall survival, and it met its endpoint. The cabozantinib was superior to best supportive care in those lines of setting, showing overall survival benefit. Therefore, the cabozantinib is currently approved in second line setting as well. Other than TKIs, there are immunotherapies available. Now, nivolumab was approved based on a single-arm phase 2 study where it shows a durable response rate. Same thing with pembrolizumab, actually was seen in the same efficacy as well and proven based on durable response rate as well. But unfortunately, as of February 20th of 2019, there was a press release. There was a keynote study that compared pembrolizumab to placebo in a second-line setting. They had a co-primary endpoint of PFS and overall survival. However, the press release that was done February 20th showed that it did not meet its endpoint. So now we're entering the area where we're not sure what to do with immunotherapy because a trial that we all thought would be positive in second-line setting was a negative study.
At the meeting, Daewon Kim, MD, a medical oncologist in the gastrointestinal oncology program at Moffitt Cancer Center, spoke to the treatment options available for patients with early-stage pancreatic cancer. When Kim sat down with us, he explained that while surgery is a therapeutic option for select patients with pancreatic cancer, many patients present with unresectable disease. Progress made in the neoadjuvant space, however, can improve the resectability of locally advanced pancreatic cancer, he added. Hear more about how recent advances made in the neoadjuvant and adjuvant settings are informing treatment strategies for patients with localized pancreatic cancer.
So basically, the neoadjuvant treatment is actually in pancreatic cancer, like even after curative surgery, the recurrence rate quite high, and then prognosis is really poor even after curative surgery. So there are a lot of trials actually to improve the survival after surgery. Especially what we know is actually the margin status is very important, one of the predictive marker of survival after surgery. So our goal is actually with the neoadjuvant chemotherapy actually improve the margin status to improve the survival, and also the neoadjuvant chemotherapy may kill the older microscopic disease outside of pancreatic cancer. So like in the borderline resectable disease, there's several data actually shows that they improve the survival after like a FOLFIRINOX, modified FOLFIRINOX treatment, and also the some chemo radiation, also neoadjuvant chemo radiation actually shows like an improvement of the survival. Well, I will discuss this one more detail in today's discussion. So one of them is actually phase 2 trial of the FOLFIRINOX data actually shows improved the R0 resection rate. R0 means actually margin negative surgery. So it actually improved. Then margin negative surgery is associated with improvement of survival.
In the advanced stage setting of pancreatic cancer, Damian Labor, MD, a hematologist, oncologist, and senior member of Moffitt Cancer Center, provided a brief history of the trials that led to current frontline and second-line standards for patients with metastatic pancreatic cancer, and shared his hope for the future of the treatment paradigm.
So on the frontline treatment, it took many, many years, basically until 2011, when the first study was published that compared the treatment with gemcitabine versus the treatment with FOLFIRINOX. And on that study, the patients were patients that have not received chemotherapy. They were either locally advanced or metastatic, and they were not candidate for any curative therapy. And the randomization was done fairly well. And the patients, the results show that the patients that receive the FOLFIRINOX, they have an improvement in the overall survival compared to the patients that receive gemcitabine. Couple of interesting points, of course, there is more toxicity with the combination. But when we look at the quality of life measurements, the quality of life was actually improved by the combination of FOLFIRINOX. Even though they have a little bit more toxicity, since patients were progressing on the gemcitabine sooner, then those patients benefited from that. As a caveat, it's not a treatment that everybody can tolerate, so patients had to have good organ function, good performance status. And those will be the important key points. The second study was actually published a couple of years later in 2013, which compared also as a control gemcitabine and single agent versus the combination of nab-paclitaxel with gemcitabine. And in that study, again, the nab-paclitaxel patients, they actually have an improvement also in the survival and the progression-free survival. They also have a little bit more toxicity, but overall was quite manageable for those patients. Again, this is a combination treatment, so patients have to have good organ function and good performance status to tolerate that. For the patients that progress after some gemcitabine combination, then I'll be presented about the Napoli study, which actually randomized patients to which is nanoparticle with liposomal irinotecan plus 5-FU versus single agent 5-FU or 5-FU leucovorin. And on that one, it shows that the single agent didn't improve much by the combination, which we call it null-IRI, plus 5FU, then that was the best arm with improvement in the progression-free survival and the overall survival. So that has been approved and is an available treatment for the second line patients that progress after some gemcitabine therapy. We don't have a true second line treatment for patients that progress after FOLFIRINOX. So most of us, we use some gemcitabine or some gemcitabine combination because we have the older data showing that clinical improvement. But more than that, we really don't know.
When we spoke with Rutika Mehta, MD, MPH, she shared how more agents continue to enter the treatment armamentarium for patients with gastric cancer or gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma, with the future bringing immunotherapy combinations to the forefront of treatment. Here, Mehta, a gastrointestinal medical oncologist at Moffitt Cancer Center, gives her take on the current gastric cancer treatment landscape and sheds light on how emerging therapies could impact the paradigm.
So FDD-TPI was studied in a phase 3 trial, acronym as TAGS. This was a randomized placebo-controlled trial. Patients were randomized to receiving FDD-TPI versus placebo. The use of FDD-TPI did show significant prolongation in the overall survival as well as progression-free survival in patients as compared to the placebo alone. There was definite improvement in the disease control rate with FDD-TPI as opposed to placebo. The major key point to note in this study was the time to duration to ECOG performance of 2 or more was significantly longer with FDD-TPI as compared to placebo. So based on all these data, this led to the FDA approval of FDD-TPI in the third line setting after failing 2 previous lines of treatment in gastric and GEJ junction cancers. Currently, the first line standard as proposed by NCCN guidelines as well as studies that were performed is fluoropyrimidine with a platinum agent, that being cisplatin or oxaliplatin. About 15-20% of gastric and GE junction cancer patients will express a protein called as HER2-neu, and patients who do express this protein, the addition of trastuzumab to the chemo backbone has shown to improve overall survival based on the TOGA trial. That's your standard first line option. When we move to the second line treatment, the REGARD and RAINBOW trials have shown that both ramucirumab in combination with paclitaxel as well as ramucirumab by single agent, both have shown overall survival benefit. So that would be your standard second line option. Again, mostly our combinations with immunotherapy, most recently with GI ASCO 2019, we saw the presentation of a phase 2 trial with pembrolizumab, trastuzumab, capecitabine, and oxaliplatin in patients with HER2-neu positive gastric and GEJ cancer in the first line setting. And it had an overall response rate of 83%. With the PD-L1 positive population being only 29%. So irrespective of PD-L1 positivity, the study was able to show a very excellent overall response rate. So similar studies have been done. There was a CheckMate 032 with the gastric and GEJ cohort, which has shown that the combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab improves overall response rates irrespective of PD-L1 status. Similarly, there was the Attraction 02 trial performed in Asia with nivolumab, again showing improvement in overall survival irrespective of PD-L1 status. There have been some other immunotherapy combinations which have not particularly shown a lot of responses, like Durva and Tremi. So therefore, we have to take it with a grain of salt, which immunotherapy agents work, what combinations might work. Other important things that has come up in the gastric cancer landscape is the molecular profiling of gastric cancer, more so the molecular subclassification of gastric cancers. We all know there are now 4 distinct subclasses of gastric cancer: MSI high, EBV positive, there's chromosomal instable, and genomically stable cancer types. MSI high and EBV positive are known to be immune rich and therefore have better sensitivity to immunotherapies. Therefore, a lot of studies are being now geared to harness this molecular subclasses to receive immunotherapy and combinations as such. The unmet need still lies in the HER2-neu positive setting. We definitely know about the TOGA trial where trastuzumab has shown to improve overall survival in the first line setting. However, post-progression of trastuzumab, we really do not have a lot of agents in the second-line setting at this current time, but a lot of studies are being done in that space.
The field of advanced colorectal cancer has seen no shortage of activity, explained Amit Mahipal, MBBS, and Iman Amanarad, MD, who spoke to the newly diagnosed and refractory settings, respectively. Mahipal, a senior associate consultant in the Division of Medical Oncology of the Department of Oncology at Mayo Clinic, who plainly stated that unless patients have a rare genetic alteration, those with metastatic disease should be treated with a chemotherapy backbone and a biologic agent in the frontline setting. However, he also acknowledged that the current paradigm can be quite complex. In our interview, Mahipal navigates the treatment paradigm of metastatic colorectal cancer and sheds light on how recent advances are impacting the outlook of those affected by the disease.
As you have seen, the treatment has changed a lot in the last 10 or so years. Right now, currently, we use a chemo backbone and then we use a biological agent. In terms of the chemo backbone, is usually either FOLFOX or Zelox or FOLFIRI or Zeliri. For most of the patient, there are some selected patients we use single agent fluoropyrimidine or more aggressive chemotherapy for FOLFOXIRI. In terms of the biological agent, usually there's a bevacizumab or one of the EGFR monoclonal antibody, cetuximab or panitumumab. We combine them based on patient factors as well as the tumor-related factors. Patient factors including age, comorbidities, performance status, pre-existing toxicity. In terms of tumor factor, looking at molecular markers that have changed the landscape, including including RAS, RAF, BRAF, MSI status, and more recently now HER2 status as well. So with the majority of the patients, you know, apart from the traditional chemotherapy, you know, we know recently TAS-102 Lonsurf, it's been a few years now that got approved. Right now, there was a one trial presented with darolizumab and tremelimumab combination, which seems to have activity even in the MMR proficient patient. So this is a small phase 2 trial. Hopefully, it will lead to a bigger phase 3 trial, and that shows that will be something immunotherapy will be an option for patients with MMR proficient. We're also doing trial even in the first line and second line setting. So we're doing in a first line, for example, end up PD-1 combination with chemotherapy in all comers. So basically, again, looking at MMR proficient patients if they can benefit from immunotherapy combinations. I think it'll be interesting to see the data with anti-PD-1 with first line therapy in combination with FOLFOX, see how that pans out. I think that would be very interesting. Right now, everyone is looking into this immuno-oncology as a next step. There have been trials going on with microbiome, and then there are also, we're doing some vaccine trial as a maintenance therapy as well. So.
Then, Amanarad, a medical oncologist at Moffitt Cancer Center, explained how although the CCTG-CO26, REDOS, and IMblaze-370 trials are not all positive, these are all pivotal trials that have shaped approaches to treating patients with advanced refractory colorectal cancer. Listen on to hear Amanarad discuss these trials in depth, as well as their impact on patients with refractory metastatic CRC.
We did discuss three abstracts today, one from ASCO, which was Canadian Clinical Trial Group CO26, a study using anti-PD-L1 and anti-CTL4 inhibition in the refractory setting. This was the study of durvalumab in combination with tremelimumab in patients who have previously received several prior lines of therapy, unselected group of patients, which showed significant improvement in overall survival of approximately 2.5 months. This was a phase 2 study. The second study was REDOS study, which was presented in GI ASCO 2018. This was a study of dose escalating regorafenib, starting at an 80 milligram dose and going up to 120 the second week, 160 the third week, and moving on. The primary endpoint of this study was to see what percentage of the people are able to complete two cycles of therapy and move on to the third cycle. And the third study was IMblaze study, which was comparison of atezolizumab in combination with cobimetinib and in comparison with atezolizumab and regorafenib. I I personally actually like the redose strategy. I think that, you know, for community oncology, I think it's important to at least know that I don't think we are doing our patients any significant harm by studying our patients low dose and dose escalating. And also with potential improvement in overall survival signal that we see in that, I think that it's a very viable option. And possibly even considering starting regorafenib sooner than, you know, than later in patients who have preserved performance status.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 48th episode of Onc Live On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science summits for those interested in attending. If you'd like to review the latest data in multiple myeloma, register for the July 18th State of the Science Summit in New York City, New York. We'll also be holding a State of the Science Summit on ovarian cancer on July 23rd in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Register now at onclive.com/meetings/SOSS. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.